Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
For decades now, the whole notion of belief, faith, has been in some turmoil. We've become much more questioning, I'd say even cynical. No longer do we accept something to be true just because someone says it's true. Other worldviews and religions have burst into the Aussie public square to an extent that would have been unthinkable just a few decades ago. Back then, preachers used to say things like, the Bible says this, the Bible says that. Now, people, probably understandably, say, well, who says that's the truth? How can that be trusted? Especially considering the behaviour of some of the church in recent decades. Yet, it's claimed there are huge implications that flow on from this shift in the whole question of faith. Tim Costello, the CEO of World Vision, says the loss of purpose and direction that characterises Western culture is having devastating social consequences. So, into all that, my next guest on Open House asks this question. My God, is it possible to believe anymore? He is author, Anglican pastor, and lecturer in theology, Michael Jensen. Michael, welcome to Open House.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you in with us. Thank you so much for coming in. Michael, why was it easier to believe in days gone by? Why is it a lot harder today?
Well, it's perhaps a more complicated question than we sometimes think it is. Sometimes we think, oh, it's just the advance of science has made religion shrink.
Yes.
But in fact, it's actually a religious answer to the question needs to be made. And that is, it used to be that you didn't so much believe as just join. You were part of a church institution. And in one sense, it was religious professionals who did the believing for you. But then something very significant happened, and that was in the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, and belief became something that ordinary people like you and me had to do. It became a choice, something that we know about in our own existences, and that actually changed things a lot. It actually opened up the world to scientific study, and there's a kind of a very fascinating history about the beginning of modern science there. But it meant that you had to think about it. And that meant that you could think about alternatives as well, perhaps not believing. And so while many, many, many people believe today, the idea of believing God or some form of deity, the idea of believing God is now an option as opposed to something that's just part of the air we breathe.
I wonder whether today one of the dynamics at work in this is that we believe in ourselves much, much more today, first and foremost.
We've displaced God and put in his place the human being. And again, that kind of happened in the 19th century when increasingly there was confidence that human beings could get things right, that through education and through social improvement, we could actually establish a kind of heaven on earth without resort to some religious answer. So that certainly came through, and the effects of that are very much being felt today too.
Ultimately, it seems that we're worshipping ourselves as God, that we know it all, that we know all. So who needs him?
At one level, life seems complete. At least we want to look like life is complete. So perhaps choosing the option of belief is kind of not as pressing or not as necessary, it seems, for a lot of people.
The interesting thing about faith, as you've looked at it, is that all of us exercise it, whether we believe in God or not. To not believe, to believe and trust in another worldview, is always a choice, always an exercise of faith.
I wanted to point out, often faith and reason are seen as being opposites, that you're an idiot if you have faith. I mean, that kind of word, if you go to the Twitter sphere, that's the sort of language that's used.
Yeah.
That's not the case at all. To be human is to exercise trust and faith. To get by in your day, you exercise trust and faith all over the place in different areas. And even at a basic level, your family unit is a development of trust. It's a relationship of trust and faith. And if that faith is broken, you find yourself not really knowing who you are anymore. Your identity depends on believing and trusting. But also the whole network of modern knowledge that we rely on so much is, I was flying overseas just a couple of weeks ago, and I had no idea who's flying the plane. Absolutely no. I didn't look at his qualifications. Yes. I didn't speak to him first and ask if he'd had too much to drink or if he was having a bad day or if he felt suicidal. I just got on the plane.
In trust.
In complete trust.
Do you think the consequences of this loss of faith in Western culture are as significant as Tim Costello says?
I do think there are significant consequences to this loss of faith. And it's interesting that many of the leading atheists are seeing that as well. So that Alain de Botton, who wrote a book on religion for atheists a couple of years ago now, has started to say, well, we really need to have a kind of a church thing, because we need to kind of remember the best, you know, the greatest values of the world. There's a lot of nostalgic looking over the fence to what people of faith have from intelligent atheists, I notice. And that's because if you believe really that what you see is all there is, you end up having no grounding for the kind of beauty, truth, and goodness that we so much value. You cannot be a true humanist unless you are a theologian, unless you have a God in the picture. Atheists are taking Richard Dawkins to task recently because of this, because he's inconsistent. Yes. He's a humanist and an atheist, and they say, well, no, this is untenable, actually. Yes. This is inconsistent. What ends up happening then is, I think, actually the breakdown of civilization. What we do is barbaric to one another, because in the end, just might is right. We see the vestiges of that. That's a feature of modern civilization beyond God.
So we think faith is a choice, but you say, in a way, Christian faith is an unchoosable choice. What do you mean by that?
I mean it because, in a way, Christian faith chooses you. It sort of breaks you down. It's a confrontation with a God who you can't get around, who exposes you for who you are, which is terrifying, but then you discover also in him there is mercy. There is abundant mercy. I mean, the old prayer book used to talk about God as being almighty, which is terrifying, but most merciful. That's the kind of God we encounter in Christian faith, and that overcomes our kind of sense that we might be just choosing him like a packet of chips from a supermarket aisle.
And uniquely personal. Uniquely personal.
Yes, uniquely personal, not simply a remote or distant force, but also a person who's entered into history like one of us, with whom we have a relationship akin to the sort of relationships we have within our family. And again, it's not simply an intellectual matter for that reason, Christian faith. It's a relational matter. Your relationship with your mum depends on some facts about your mum. Just as with God, there's some facts about God, but it's also a deeply personal thing, something you know in your heart as well as in your head.
Do you think we're wired for faith beyond ourselves?
I think we are wired for belief, for committing to things that transcend ourselves. Yeah, I think mostly human beings do this. It's very hard. Even atheists will say, committed atheists will say that the God habit will be very hard for human beings to break, because we seem wired for it. And I think they're right. It might be that we find, as that transcendent thing, some great cause. Might be that the environment becomes that thing, rather, or some other great cause. But we're wired for that kind of commitment, for that kind of thing.
So in your book, My God, My God, you say you converse with troubled souls, cranks, crackpots, conspiracy theorists, even the devil himself. What are some of the things they say about belief and about faith today?
I think one of the funny things about the way we think about believing in things these days is that part of public dialogue and discussion of faith issues, it features people who are very strange sometimes. In that particular discussion, I was interested in challenging both establishing and confirming our faith in the ordinary process of scientific discovery, human knowing as it is, but also saying, actually, you know, sometimes crackpots are right. It's funny how often that doesn't mean we should believe crackpots just because they're crackpots, but sometimes it's the oddball, it's the non-specialist, it's the person who can stand outside the guild, the club, who actually hits on the truth. There's one scientist, I tell the story of this particular scientist, it's confirmed that his particular crackpot theory was right, and he wins a prize age 96. And when he receives the prize, he says the disappointing thing is I can't actually laugh at those people who said I was wrong all these years because they're all dead.
The devil, as I said, was part of this conversation, which might seem a risky, even spooky thing to do. Take us through how you deal with the devil and the devil's role in both the physical world and the spiritual world.
People are fascinated by the devil. The devil in the Bible is less the cartoon figure that we imagine and more the accuser. And the question of his existence, in one sense, is a boring question. Does he exist? Does he actually walk around with a tail and horns and all the rest? The point of the devil is that there is a reality which he describes, which he encapsulates. And that reality is that human beings are imperfect, less than, more than imperfect. Human beings are troubled. Human beings, in theological language, they are sinful, and they stand accused. That's his name. Satan's name is accuser. That means we need a way out of that bind. I wanted to introduce this in because so often we treat issues of faith and doubt as a intellectual exercise.
Yeah.
It's partly an intellectual exercise, but it's an existential exercise to do with who we are. And these things that we do show us that we're not really ourselves. We're kind of beings turned in on themselves, as Martin Luther used to say. We're the prisoners of our own behavior. We don't do even the good we would do. That's a remarkable thing. You have this kind of dialogue with ourselves, don't
yes,
we?
Yes, yes.
We can speak of ourselves as a kind of other person. There's two of us. There's the person I think I am and the person that my actions show that I am.
Yeah.
And that to me is a profoundly difficult personal issue that a lot of people are wrestling with. I know a lot of people who would say they actively believe, have never rejected Christianity or never said that they don't believe in Christianity. The trouble they have is believing that Christianity is for them. They really can't accept that forgiveness, that the grace of God is something that really is for them. I think this is more widespread than just the people we would classically think as bad people in prison or drug addicts or something like that. There's a lot of us who really think the grace of God could not be for me. It seems somehow that system doesn't work. It's not mine.
Perhaps one of the reasons is because we have that accusing voice in our heads,
yes,
in our lives. So where do we go with that then?
Yeah, well, this is the devil's great trick, is to keep reminding you of how bad you are. Because he's half right. He's a great teller of half-truths, just as happened in the Garden of Eden. He tells kind of half-truths. The thing is to remember, of course, that God is just and righteous and holy. He's got that right. And we are not. But that God in his holiness is merciful. God is the great justifier. This was Martin Luther's great insight from the book of Romans. The book of Romans kind of gets this, takes a paradox and makes it work. The paradox is God is just and he justifies the ungodly. You can't square that circle. It's,
yes.
It's,
yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. How does it make sense? Because out of his great mercy, Christ died for the ungodly. Even while we're still God's enemies, Christ dies. And that means that the mercy of God is showered upon human beings, that the grace of God is available to all. That would be the thing I'd really like people reading my book to come away with.
Can you explain to us how it is that you can compare Christian faith with getting a joke? Because yes, it's an interesting idea.
I'm trying very hard to think of ways to speak about Christian faith. It's not intellectual assent to a bunch of propositions. Yeah. It's more like falling in love or getting a joke. A friend of mine calls it speaks of it as falling in love. I think I'll take that. But also getting a joke. What do I mean by getting a joke? Well, a joke, this is how a joke works. A joke takes two things you don't expect, puts them together, and they make surprising sense. And then when you look back, the world is a kind of a different place. A really good joke kind of changes the world, really.
Yes, yeah.
A number of thinkers have thought of this. Milton Jones, the British comedian, currently working comedian, he's written a whole book called 10-Second Sermons on this, and it was his sort of humour that picked this up to me. He kind of equated faith to getting a joke. And also the great preacher and writer, Frederick Buechner from America, in his 80s and 90s now, but he wrote about Christian faith as comic. And it is. It's surprising. It's a man rising from the dead. It's the creation of everything from nothing. I mean, you wouldn't expect it ahead of time, but yet when it happens, it actually makes sense of everything that went before. So it does make sense. Everything comes into line when you get the joke. That means some people don't get the joke, of course. Some people refuse to see that those two things make sense. But I want to invite you to look at what's being said and see if you do get the joke. Jesus spoke of his parables in this way too.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
These parables were these teasing stories. Some people got them and some people kind of hung on and wanted to know more. And some people just didn't get it.
Yeah. One of the big questions you pose is probably one of the most significant. In this age of pragmatism, does it work? Does it?
It works. But it mightn't work in the way we measure working. This is very crucial for modern people. We're very pragmatic. We're very work-oriented, very busy. The bottom line is the thing that communicates. Our politicians basically speak in this way, not necessarily about philosophy. Yeah. They're not interested in that anymore. Ideals, what they're interested in is the bottom line, what actually works. The Christian faith does work remarkably well as a way to live. It is an extraordinarily workable way to live. It actually, I think, makes you happy in a way. I saw this show on called Making Australia Happy, and what they were recommending there for you to do to make yourself happy, this is the science of happiness, they called it, was that you should sing, you should do things for other people, you should contemplate your own death, you should seek forgiveness from people you've wronged, and you should give thanks for things.
Wow.
This sounds to me like becoming a Christian. Sure, you should just become a Christian and be done with. Now, the thing about that is that that's not all there is to say. Of course, being a Christian may get you killed. As we know, in many places in the world, being a Christian may cause you, doesn't spare you from suffering. Being a Christian doesn't make you wealthy. Being a Christian doesn't spare you from diseases or from all the, you're still living in the world here. But being a Christian gives you hope. And hope is actually the really wonder ingredient here because it means that you can have joy in the midst of the worst the world can throw at a person. I don't mean by joy avoidance or simply kind of happy feelings. I mean what hope gives you. James speaks of this remarkable words. He says, consider it pure joy when you suffer all kinds of trials. And you think of him, what are you, some kind of masochist?
Yes.
And no, that's not it at all. What he's saying is, in fact, you've got hope. When the world throws things at you, actually, this is just lashings of the lizard's tail. It's been cut off from its body. It's a sign, in fact, that God is working his purposes out and that you're secure in him. And that's a remarkable way to live.
And ultimately, as you deal with it in the face of death, and whenever we've explored the issue of death on Open House, we've had a huge response. We might see it as the great taboo, but I always think people want to listen about it, almost irresistibly drawn to it. You say that death forces on us an entirely new view of life.
Death forces us, if we really think about death, death forces us to count our days. Remember how brief our life is and how tenuous our hold on it is, how fragile we are. Often think of the way we build houses and we save and we put a lifetime of dedication into a house that in the end we live in for just but a few decades, then it passes on to someone else. It looks like it's solid, but we're just like the wind, you know, we just disappear. That should give us pause for thought, of course. But the Christian message doesn't avoid talk of death. It asks us to stare right at death. But it shows us a way through and beyond death. This is, of course, what happens to Jesus. He doesn't avoid death. He doesn't kind of step aside and kind of go behind the curtain just when the worst comes. He goes through death and out to the other side. I think sometimes religion is used, forms of the Christian faith even, are used as a way of avoiding death and suffering and pain. But that, I don't think, is biblical faith at all. The Bible, as I say in my book, is a messy book. It's a book in the middle of things.
Yeah, that's right. Your conclusion is that believing is untidy, but it is possible.
It's untidy because the world's untidy and because we are frail. It's not untidy because God is imperfect or God doesn't communicate or God is silent, but it's untidy because our experience of life is ultimately untidy. So I'm sorry if you're obsessive compulsive. if you're a neat person, yeah, that's the reality. And I think also we need to be honest about this. Whenever I've spoken, even at theological college, about the untidiness of Christian faith, it's really struck a chord because I think Christian leaders find that believing is untidy. I get up in the pulpit sometimes and I don't feel like I'm really, I don't really know. I'm not as confident as I was the week before.
Yeah.
And I think a bit of honesty on this wouldn't hurt.
A bit of honesty doesn't hurt at all. Michael Jensen, I think it's been a really fascinating and helpful conversation. The book is My God, Is It Possible to Believe Anymore? We'll put the details up on our Open House Community Facebook page. Michael, thank you so much indeed for coming in.
Thank you, Lee. It's been a pleasure.
Good on you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.